Welcome to the Pro-Gender podcast series, produced by the Center for Gender Studies at Pandion University and Recollective. Pro-Gender explores the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on gender relations. Its aim is to promote debates and responses to the multiple gender challenges that have emerged during the pandemic. The project is funded by the European Economic Area Financial Mechanism 2014 to 2021. Hello, I'm Saskia Fischer, and I'm a member of Recollective. In this podcast, we look at women in the university. For those who follow debates within academia, the idea that women working in universities lost out during the pandemic is now almost a given. Their abilities to research and publish were diminished, partly because they were the ones who assumed the lion's share of care responsibilities, not only at home or in their communities, but also within universities, in terms of the pastoral care of students. So the pandemic, it has been shown, has exacerbated existing gender and other inequalities, both within and beyond the university. Without concerted action, these developments are likely to have long-lasting impacts for women. It's in this context that I spoke with three academics, each of whom is involved in some aspect of this issue. Our three interviewees, Sofia Moratti, Irini Apumogli, and Vanessa Marr, are based in Norway, Greece, and the UK. In what follows, they share their reflections on some of the challenges of working in the university, especially during the pandemic. Sofia Moratti discusses her research on the gendered metaphors that circulate in academia, changes to gender equality policies in Norwegian universities, and the theory of gender as a status as a way of explaining the persistence of gender inequality. Irini Apumogli talks about the University of Crete's gender lab and her own research with rural women, as well as the dilemmas faced by the university's gender equality committee as it attempts to tackle gender-based violence on campus. Finally, Vanessa Marr shares her research on women's roles and labor within and outside of universities and describes several of her projects, in one of which women explored their experiences of juggling domestic and academic labor during the pandemic by making a quilt collectively. Although each of our guests comes to the question of women in the university from a distinct angle, some common themes emerge: the persistently unequal division of labor in academia and the difficulties women face in their working lives there, the sexist metaphors through which women are represented and constricted, and finally, the pandemic as a setback to gender equality. Despite emphasizing these challenges, however, our guests also sound a positive note about the next generation of students and academics, as well as some new possibilities opened up by the pandemic. And now over to our interviewees. We start with Sofia Moratti.
First of all, thank you for interviewing me. It's a pleasure to do this interview with you. I work at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, Faculty of Humanities, Center for Gender Research, which is part of the Department of Interdisciplinary Studies of Culture. I am an associate professor, and prior to working at NTNU, where I have been working since 2016, I used to work at the European University Institute as a postdoctoral researcher, and then later as a senior researcher. And before then, I work in different places, but most importantly, what I should mention is that I got my PhD from the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. So basically, this is me and where I come from. And I have been working in Norway in particular on gender equality in academia.
And can I ask you how you came to this gender lens in your work?
I think it's mainly lived experience, really. It's a lived experience of being a woman in academia for a relatively long time, especially if you've been working, I think, in multiple contexts. And then you see some dynamics that tend to resurface, even in contexts that are completely different. That was striking. It's gender, the dynamics that I'm talking about, naturally. Generally, also because of my background, I am interested in the professions. I've been doing a lot of work on the medical profession previously and now on academics as a profession, but in a gender perspective. I think working on gender and gender equality in a Scandinavian country was a very interesting opportunity and very educational for me. It has given me a lot.
Great. And could you tell us what you're working on currently?
Multiple projects, but my main focus of interest really is on gender in academia. And I am looking at both decision-making processes and representations, like decision-making processes, for example, academic selection, professional accreditation, and the role that gender can play in academic selection, and representations, for example, how are women academics represented in language. So I have done a study on the metaphors used to describe women academics, their gendered experiences and careers. In which terms do we speak of women academics, and what does that say about our assumption and our thoughts? These are really quite, I would say, old problems that have been there for a very long time. I would say a key issue here is the dilemma of persistence. How comes that certain types of dynamics and representations persist despite the societal change that has taken place, despite active attempts to address these issues through policies, for example? Very often, particularly in gender studies, there is some focus on the neoliberal change that has taken place in academia. In the Nordics and beyond the Nordics, particularly in the past couple of decades, there have been a number of reforms, and everywhere academia is increasingly dependent on external funding. That has been indicated as a key factor in worsening, producing gender inequality. I really agree with that. I really think neoliberalism is something that we should be tackling as an ideology, as gender scholars. However, the problem of gender inequality was there well before. I think it's important to come to the understanding that gendered dynamics are older than any specific form of academic governance. Personally, I am very fascinated by the theory of gender as status and the work of Cecilia Ridgway, along with race. For example, gender is one of the primary frameworks that we use to categorize others rapidly. And this categorization is based on our assumptions that we have absorbed through socialization that result from a long history of gender segregation. And these kind of assumptions sort of drive our interactions with others in a particular direction. They drive our behavior. They influence how we treat others. They create hierarchies, reinforce hierarchies that are already in place.
Could you talk to us a bit about your work on the use of metaphors in academia, and maybe give us some examples of the gendered use of metaphors and how these relate to status?
I wrote a paper on this question recently. There has been a lot of discussion around metaphors like leaky pipeline and glass ceiling, because they allude to rigid structures. So they cloud women's agency and they cloud the responsibility of academia as a work environment and society in maintaining gender inequality. So those metaphors have been problematized for a long time. What I have done is problematizing another cluster of metaphors that I found in scholarly papers that discuss gender in academia as a work environment, and are metaphors taken from fairy tales, for example, myths, folklore. There are a lot of them actually allude to the unequal status of women in academia. Cinderella. Cinderella or Cinderellas are the women who take care of all the drudgery in their departments while being excluded from the most prestigious tasks. Other metaphors are fairy godmother for a female mentor, for instance. And these metaphors are very interesting because they really say a lot about how we think of gender inequality in academia, but they do it in a manner that is more interesting than explicit reasonings. They disclose the implicit, they disclose our assumptions and the assumption that we're not aware of in a wonderful manner. We don't think that much when we use metaphors, or not as much as we think when we try to construct a rational reasoning.
Do you have thoughts about the situation where you are now in Norway versus other places in terms of gender equality and inequality in the university in particular?
Well, I think what makes Norway stand out internationally is the amount of resources and efforts that are invested into trying to understand the phenomenon of gender inequality in academia and beyond academia and intervening. Historically, Norway has been pioneering gender quotas also in business. So an active intervention by the legislator to, even though times are changing here as well, and because of the individualization of how we think about our careers and about working life, install gender equality is perceived as normal in Norway. Active intervention for gender equality are met with more resistance, and also the meritocracy narratives in academia are typically framed as standing in opposition with gender equality efforts. And this kind of international discourse is beginning to have a role in the Norwegian discourse as well, among researchers and academics and beyond. However, I still think that Norway is exceptional. We had some professorships that were meant for women only, in the sense that the person was chosen with a competitive process, but only women were allowed to apply. But a student or a doctoral student complained to a European court, the European Free Trade Association court, and the provision was repealed. Okay, so because why? Because it's not gender neutral. And the understanding, the liberal understanding of gender equality at the supranational level is one of gender neutrality. So the Norwegian government continued its commitment toward gender equality in academia through other means, so not by creating specific positions for women only. However, the mentality is still one of strong support, I think, for gender equality.
And do you think the pandemic has had any specific impacts on this, like on working conditions for women in universities?
I would say, if I were to say what I found most striking in my personal experience and the experience of the people around me, working from home has become very normalized in a already highly digitalized society, such as a Norwegian society. Infrastructures were already very good for digitalization infrastructure, so people can pretty much count on excellent internet connection. And the Norwegians used to be big travelers, especially big flyers. In addition to environmental sustainability considerations, I have seen also personal sustainability considerations made. Compatibility with family life, for instance. So an increasingly moving collaborations from physical meetings to online meetings changes people's sense of distance, I think. It changes our perceptions. It is a game changer for dual career couples, people who have care obligations, for instance. And it can be both good or bad for gender inequality. I mean, there is more boundary work involved if you're working from home, in making it clear that you won't be available past a certain time, that it is difficult to spend a day of non-stop meetings on Zoom, for instance. So the drawing boundaries and boundary negotiation may have become more complex, but at the same time, there's a new flexibility, I think, and a new acceptance of hybrid solutions, and that gives more freedom, and that can also be used to the advantage of people working in academia, in the sense that it doesn't detract from your work quality, but it makes your everyday life more sustainable, especially if you have a family or if you're an expat. The best thing that can happen to us is that we use the pandemic as a learning opportunity, and we keep the good instead of mindlessly switching back to the way things were before. And I see some actually positive signs there. The sustainability is becoming more central to the discourse of the ideal academic and what it means to be an academic. I trust the adaptability of higher education professionals that are used to learning new content quickly and to adjusting to new conditions. And I hope that this disastrous pandemic that has been bad in so many respects will also bring some positive consequences, and that the flexibility will not amount to work invading your private life entirely, but rather on finding new balance, a better balance.
Hello, I am Irini Abumogli. I am currently a postgraduate student in sociology at the University of Crete. I'm just writing my thesis now. I come from a completely different background. I studied theater. I have worked as an actress and as a drama teacher in different drama schools. And as an actress, I'm still working. I have been a feminist activist, not since a couple of years and due to the pandemic at all, and also before, but I have participated in grassroots feminist activist groups and initiatives that had to do mostly with rape culture and how to fight rape culture in everyday life. I also studied in Greece, in Brussels, and then back in Greece, I did a master degree in stage directing. And then I decided that I want to study sociology because of feminism, I would say. For the last couple of years, I have been collaborating with the Gender Lab of the University of Crete, which is a research laboratory for gender studies. The Gender Lab was founded in 2004. It was a period also in Greece that women's studies and gender studies at the university were really funded by the EU. There were programs co-funded by the EU and the Greek government. And they were undergraduate programs about women and gender. The Gender Lab was founded then and it continued until now, but it went through a phase like the economy of Greece that it was completely underfunded, so it stopped researching and stuff. Now it's getting again very energetic about women and agriculture, the agricultural profile of the island. So there are workshops on women's entrepreneurship or research on gender relations in Crete, or educational programs in schools. And we are trying to create, we already have, and we are organizing a big archive that we want to offer to anyone who is interested in working and researching on gender.
So is your research about rural women in Crete?
Yes, I did do a project on rural women in Crete, and it is still something that interests me. My thesis is about that. It's about how they constitute their subjectivity of women in the village of Crete, based on their personal life narratives.
And could you tell us how you came to work on these questions?
I take this research about the lives of rural women and their construction of subjectivity, let's say, very personally. And I'm really engaged in this because my mother is from Crete and she grew up in a village, in a small village in the mountain. You still see this power dynamics of the patriarchy, very lively, let's say. So this is one part of the research that I am interested in. And the other part of my research and my work and my personal interest is sexual harassment at the university.
Could you tell us about the work of the Gender Equality Committee, which you're a part of?
The Gender Equality Committee of the University of Crete was founded in 2020 after a law of the state in 2019 that made an invitation to all the universities to create gender equality committees. And I was invited specifically by Professor Funarek to participate as an associate member in the Gender Discrimination Studies Group. I think it was a very, very important step towards equality. Actually, I don't know if it's a step towards equality, but it's definitely a step towards visibility of gender issues. Because it's not that because the Equality Committee exists, there are no gender issues, but exactly the opposite. It's because gender issues exist that we need a Gender Equality Committee. I don't want to look down on institutional initiatives, but at the same time, they are not at the least enough when talking about gender inequality or talking about LGBTQI plus issues at the university and attitudes. And in my opinion, the problem with these institutional initiatives is that they lack the bottom-up perspective. I mean, since the Gender Equality Committee was founded, we have heard about 3 or 4 issues of harassment and gender-based violence at the university. So I guess that's good. It means that people speak up. It's not that they happen now, of course. So just that people speak up about it. But I have this feeling, and discussing with other undergraduate students or postgraduate students, that I'm not sure that people really trust the institution. People trust person, you know, it has to be more personal. It's not about, because in the end, the committee only has a mediating role. So if it gets a sexual harassment complaint, the only thing that the committee can do is, you know, give advice or pass the complaint on to the dean. So it's not really some kind of power. And in general, I think that at least in Crete, the Gender Equality Committee is a bit, you know, old school. We are still talking about the binary of gender. There's a long way to go in order to talk about LGBTQ plus or trans visibility in the union. It's very much about he and she all the time.
And what do you see as the relations between feminist struggles in and out of the university? So you mentioned that you've been a feminist activist, and this is a huge question, I realize.
No, I know, but it is a question about, you know, radical grassroots feminism and institutions and how feminists that go in the university are no longer connected to grassroots feminism, or that when feminism entered academia, it lost its, you know, power and social rapport. There is this opinion here in Greece that the academic feminists are sold out. I don't agree. I think that theory and practice should go hand in hand. I am of this point of view.
Can I ask you how you see the relation between the situation in Greece and that in other countries in terms of gender relations and power dynamics?
I really don't know. I mean, I don't want to generalize and say, you know, Europe is better or worse. I really don't know. I should study something about this. What I have noticed, because with the Gender Equality Committee, we have created a guide to prevent sexual harassment at the university. In order to create this brochure, we really researched brochures about sexual harassment from other universities. So I did see that a lot of European universities and a lot of universities in USA, they do have this kind of guides and brochures and monitoring units about gender-based violence in campuses. So I guess that means, as in our case, that, yeah, gender harassment and gender violence do exist everywhere. I don't know how, you know, covered up they are. This is another discussion, because it doesn't have to be about brutal physical violence. Gender-based violence is also, you know, psychological abuse. And especially when we're talking about this kind of academic environments and power relations that have to do with status, then this status-based, let's say, abuse, of course, it's more secret and hidden. And this was also my experience at the university. Because when I entered the sociology department of the University of Crete, I felt that it was a really safe space, because at last I felt that I could say that I'm a feminist and I wasn't frowned upon, or really felt that I was getting respect and support. But then I worked at a research program, and there I was really shocked, because the supervisor of the research program, in the beginning, he was, you know, very open and friendly. And as time went by, he showed that he was actually sexist and misogynist. And then he was just psychologically abusive. You wouldn't expect, actually, to meet this kind of person. I really didn't expect it. And because power relations and power abuse is a slowly evolving condition, it's not about grand gestures, even though it could in the end, you know, lead to femicide or physical abuse. It's difficult for a person to describe it in a few words, to say he did this and that and that. It's a whole, you know, process of abusing a person's psyche, really. On the one hand, you could say that, yeah, but now you have the Gender Equality Committee, so you can just file a complaint. But it's not that simple, because there are difficulties in challenging this kind of unequal power relations, let's say, and this power dynamics. He's a professor, I'm a student, he's a man, I'm a woman. He arrived to be a professor being this sexist person that he is.
Are you aware of other experiences of sexual harassment at the university?
Well, the first thing that went really viral was an online abuse, online harassment during COVID. And that's another thing, that it felt like during the pandemic period and during lockdown, the harassment just changed field. It didn't really, transform. It just moved with the times and went from physical harassment to cyber harassment.
And can you tell us a bit more about the cyber harassment and what was done about it?
The cyber harassment was about a group chat on Messenger from students of a certain department of the university. And there was this guy, also a student from this department, that harassed women students on this chat. He was reported. They knew who he was. I mean, it was probably his name on the chat. And so far, there hasn't been. There has been research, and he was invited to confess, and there was a big discussion, etc. But I think that until this moment, there hasn't been a final conclusion on what's going to happen to him. Because this is also an issue. Since universities have a different function from the state, universities are independent, let's say. So the penalty differs. He's not going to go to prison or something like that, or I don't know if he has to pay any money, but he's going to have a penalty regarding his status as a student. But we don't know exactly what this is. Also, the Gender Equality Committee is working with the law department of the university to find what is the penalty for this kind of attitudes. This is maybe a reason why people are reluctant to report. We don't know what's going to happen.
And thinking about these questions of gender equality and harassment at the university, what do you see as necessary for change to be sped up or made deeper?
I want to be optimistic about the future in the university, especially. I see that also undergraduate students are at the Gender Equality Committee, that are very energetic and very and activist about gender issues. So this is very good. I have a very good feeling about new professors that are coming to the university, especially women, but also men. And I'm really longing for some more queer people at the university in positions of authority, let's say, because you can see it, you know, the student body is becoming more and more a queer body, let's say. And I really like that. I like that. I hope, I believe that at some point, it's really up to all to the professors that are already there, I think, to create the circumstances so that the students trust them. There are some of them that are like this. I am optimistic about the university, but I am very pessimistic about the society. I do believe that we are making an extreme right turn as a society, as a whole, and this will reflect at the universities at some point. But I think that new students are the hope of the university. Queer students as well. Feminism has a long way to go still. I believe that.
My name's Vanessa Marr. I'm a principal lecturer at the University of Brighton, which is on the south coast in England. I've been working at the University of Brighton for about the last 5 to 8 years. I'm course leader for an undergraduate course called Design for Digital Media, which I began working with because my background is in graphic design. So I used to work as an art editor in publishing, and then I ran my own business for 10 years. Within my business, we work particularly with charitable and not-for-profit organisations, which is definitely something that I've brought into the way that I approach work at the university as well. So I'm involved in a number of boards, for example, the Athena Swan Board, which is an initiative to support women in research across many different areas, originally in science, but now crosses over into arts and humanities as well. I also live in this area. And whilst I've moved around the southeast of England a little bit, I've always lived in this part of England. My research is focused on exploring the roles that women take in society and within organisations such as universities. I'm particularly interested in expectations that sit within a domestic context, which I see translated into the university environment as well as at home. Within that, I'm particularly interested in the legacy of stitch, the legacy of cloth. Fundamentally, it's the inequalities that I see women still experiencing that have actually frustrated me since I was a child, and something that continues to bother me, something that I want to be outspoken, I want to articulate within my research, that I want to make work that comments upon that. And the deeper I'm going into my research, the more I'm finding opportunities to do that in a variety of academic contexts. But I particularly enjoy doing it in collaborative contexts, because that's an opportunity for women to come together in solidarity, to use things such as craftivism, but not necessarily in a campaigny type of way, which sometimes it's explored in that context, more in terms of giving women a voice and as a means of kind of being vocal about the things that are unequal, about the things that need to change. Because I think that as soon as we begin to point out those inequalities, people then start to take notice of those inequalities. They then become a conversation, and they then become something that can then feed into and out of research, and it becomes a community of practice, which is really what I want to be part of. And so I have built my whole career, done all of my study with kids in tow. And I've really noticed that in addition to working, in addition to studying, there's a whole other job that sits on top of that, that is partly of my expectation, because I'm following and mirroring the way that I was brought up, but also because I think when things aren't questioned, they just happen. You fall into a role. And I think all of those things have built towards wanting to make a difference.
Great. And so maybe now, yeah, you could tell us more about both the Dusters Project and also the Domestic Academics Project.
Yeah, sure. So the Duster Project came from master's study, and I was exploring the domestic origins of fairy tales. And so I started working with the Dusters because I wanted to reference the legacy of skills passed to be to me by my my mother and my grandmothers, both of whom taught me to knit and sew and things like that. And I wanted to reference the legacy of women working with cloth and with stitch, and the links that are made to that in terms of women's powerfulness and powerlessness. So I chose the Duster because I wanted a cloth. I wanted something that when you looked at it, you read domestic. And I stitched various fairy tales phrases onto them. And I had the idea to see whether or not other people would also be interested in using the Duster as a catalyst to talk about their domestic experiences. And then before I knew it, I had a kind of a critical mass, and I held an exhibition, thought that would be the end of it. And from that point onwards, I kept on getting invitations. It's grown and grown and grown. It's now been running since 2014. But one of the really great things about it is the stories that come with the Dusters, and it's always a personal story. And yes, it's to do with domesticity, but it's not to do with dusting or cleaning. Actually, that's a routine. It's about all of the things that women could be doing if they weren't bound by this legacy of having to do everything else as well. So earlier in the year, I'd written a chapter called The Domestic Academic for an autoethnographic publication called Storing the Self. And I'd positioned myself as this domestic academic, and I'd done a number of stitched portraits and thought about the fact that within the academic context, I could see that I was taking on domestic roles as well, more caring, more organizing, more kind of default invisible work that was the glue that made things happen, which is at once both rewarding and frustrating. You know, there are lots of positives that come out of that as well, but it's the invisibility and the taken for grantedness of it that was really frustrating me. And I came across an article which said, and this was about 6 weeks into the first lockdown in the UK, so mid-April probably 2020, and it talked about how research outputs from men had grown and they'd almost bottomed out from women. And I thought, yes, this really sums up how I feel, because not only have I been told to take my teaching online overnight, not only am I supporting students pastorally more than I've ever needed to before, not only is my youngest daughter learning from home, not only have my older children come home and are now working from my house as well, and my little study space I'd managed to carve for myself after years of working on the kitchen table, I'm now sharing with my husband, who's now working from home. And how can I possibly have a whole thought, let alone a whole paragraph that might be something that vaguely resembled research? Because the constant interruptions, the constant expectation that because I'm mum and I'm the woman, I will be here and I will be available. There are all of these challenges, and I thought, this can't just be me. And I know that stitching is a way of referencing this female legacy, these female inequalities. And is there a way that I can join those two things together? So I had the idea to make the domestic academic quilt, and there would be squares. And when you clicked on each of those squares, you would hear the particular academic talking about their experiences. And that was one of the most brilliant experiences that I've ever had working with the women on that. One of the biggest things that came out of it was that without fail, every single academic put themselves at the bottom of the pile. Without fail, everyone gave their husbands the space to work privately or quietly if that was an option. Without fail, everyone put their children's homeschooling and their space to do that ahead of their own. And many, many of the women were working alongside their kids. So simultaneously running a course, giving tutorials, running classes, whatever they might be doing alongside kids. And that period of time, which we're still not really out of, there is a really, really serious risk that there is research that should have come from women that hasn't, because we went back in time and the inequalities that are faced domestically played out in the workplace and played out in academia.
Could you talk a bit about like the inequalities that exist in universities as workplaces for women, how they were like before COVID?
From my own experience and for experience I'm aware of for others, it's not equal because we often take a part-time role when we have small children, and it is much, much harder to get research funding and to grow your career when you're in a part-time role, because the reality of part-time working is that you do a bit more than the work that you would do as a part-timer. And you're also managing another job on top of that, whether that be another job that's paid or in addition to that, the other job, which is running a household and looking after the kids, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not saying men don't do that, because they do, but the default, in my experience, still sits with women. I am obviously talking from a heterosexual household perspective. So I do appreciate that, you know, for those not in that context, it might be different. And that I'm talking from a heteronormative mother and father and kids. And I really recognize and respect that that is not everyone's experience. Pre-COVID, the inequalities were there. They existed because of part-time working. They existed because of the trend in academia towards contracts that aren't permanent and there are more women in them. I think the invisibility of tasks that women tend to take on, the organising, the extra pastoral care. If you look like mum and you sound like mum, an 18-year-old undergraduate is more likely to come and talk to you than they are to someone who doesn't. And if then your response is to consciously or unconsciously behave a bit like mum, then you end up in that sort of repeating scenario, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's a piece of work that's not on your workload agreement. It's a piece of work that's not recognised and acknowledged. In COVID, I think everything was dropped. There was an acknowledgement that people were under, you know, strain in terms of mental health and hours and time and things, but I didn't see that actually mitigated. I didn't see there being extra time for staff to do things, lots for students, but the same expectations seem to persist for staff. The inequalities with regards to gender right across the workplace, not just in academia, really were highlighted and were acknowledged and were written about in the main press. You know, there was the article that I referred to was in The Guardian. And there were things like, you know, I'm living the life of the 1950s housewife. These were things that were being discussed in popular culture. And I think that can only be a good thing.
Do you like, what are the other, so both positive, hopeful and kind of challenging or challenges that you see, like thinking ahead into the future in terms of making actually substantive improvements in gender equality in universities in particular?
I think there are ongoing initiatives such as Athena Swan in the UK, which support women. They were there before COVID, but I think they're all the more poignant now. Academia seemed to me to be an opportunity to be somewhere where as a woman, I could be acknowledged as a middle-aged woman, because middle-aged women in society become invisible. And this seemed to be an area that I could potentially develop in. My School of Art and Media, the dean is a woman. Two of the associate deans are women. That's good. That's inspiring to me. The leadership team that I'm in has maybe as many women as there are men. Not so much at course leadership level, but certainly at the other level of leadership that I'm in. So I see that. I see women breaking into these leadership roles, and that's inspiring. But I think there is a level, lecturer to senior lecturer, where I don't think there is enough support. And that actually, you know, not everyone wants to become dean or a professor. Some people are very, very happy and have a million fantastic things to contribute being a senior lecturer. That's no less a position. And those women should be given the time and the opportunity to complete research and to accelerate their careers in on a level that takes them in lots of different directions, not necessarily up. You know, our trajectory does not always have to be upwards.
And thinking like about the connections between like gender inequality and movements towards like more equal working conditions in the university, about what you see as the connections between like what's going on in the university and what's going on in more broadly.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know how optimistic I feel about that, except maybe for the next generation. With the Duster Project, often it's middle-aged women who are responding to it because they empathize with the conversation. But I also have worked with Girl Guides. I also have worked with undergraduate students and postgraduate students, you know, in their sort of late teens, early 20s. And it's interesting to see the way that they respond to it. For the next generation, I hope that there is choice. And I do see that happening in the conversations that I witness from my own children and from my students, and from responses to the Duster Project from primarily girls who've been involved in it, particularly those who are early to mid teenagers. What are they, Gen Z or something they're called, aren't they? Oh my goodness, that generation are going to change the world. They will not stand for anything. They are so articulate and so aware of politics in a way that I never was when I was that age back in the 1980s. And they really see injustice and say, right, well, we need to do something about it. So I really hope that that is something that plays out across gendered roles, across academia, across the workplace as well. I don't know that they would stand for what I have considered normal, and I hope they don't.
This podcast was produced by the Center for Gender Studies at Pandion University and Recollective as part of the ProGender podcast series. For more information, go to progender.pandion.gr.